You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hi, I'm Robert W. Schneider, and welcome to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast, a companion piece to the Routledge Press publication, 50 Key Stage Musicals, which is available for purchase by going to Routledge.com or clicking the link below in today's show description. Today's episode focuses on Chapter 47, Next to Normal. And with us today is the co-creator of Next to Normal, Brian Yorkie. Brian received the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for Drama, as well as the 2009 Tony Award for Best Score for Next to Normal. He was also nominated for the Tony Award for Best Musical and Best Book of a Musical for Next to Normal, and his work on the show earned him the Outer Critics Circle Award for Best Score. He's a graduate of Columbia University, an alum of the BMI Lehman Engel Musical Theater Workshop, and a proud member of the Dramatists Guild and the WGA. Brian, I am so happy that you're joining us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Robert. Thank you for having me. It's an honor.
I am so happy that you're here. It's an honor for me. So let me ask you a question you asked me before we went on the air, which is, where did you get the theater bug from?
Well, I also had parents you mentioned you had parents who took you to Broadway. I didn't live anywhere near Broadway, but from a young age, our parents would take us to touring shows. I remember being, I think I was 7 or 8 and saw a touring production of Oliver, which may have been sort of a small bus and truck touring production, but I'm like 7 or 8 years old. And there's this kid up there playing Oliver who's like, you know, he's probably older than that, but playing 7 or 8. And I just remember looking at him and going, wait, how does he get to be up there? And I'm here in the audience. And so that set me on sort of a journey of being super interested in theater in high school. And I was mostly an actor. And then at a certain point, I realized that I really did not have any talent as an actor, but I wanted to keep doing theater. So I tried writing, and I was lucky to have a theater in my hometown outside Seattle, Washington, called Village Theater, which was a regional producer of mostly musicals. But in the summer had a program where they sort of turned the theater over to young people. And so we would make our own shows, and we eventually got the bug to start writing our own shows.
Do you remember the first show that you wrote, Brian?
You know, the first musical that I wrote was an adaptation of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Ooh.
And this was, we were trying to get the rights. This was many, many years ago. I'm not going to date myself by saying how many. Although people can always Google. It was many years ago, and we wanted to do the musical and the songs from the original Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory movie, but could not figure out, just at that time it wasn't licensed, and we tried to get the rights, and it just seemed impossible to get the rights. So I, being kind of precocious and kind of naive, which is a very dangerous combination, wrote to Roald Dahl, who at the time was still alive. I wrote to his agency, and his agent wrote back. This was before the days of email. This was all accomplished by snail mail. And his agent said, you know, Roald is you know, willing to grant you the rights to do a limited production, as, you know, as we understand it, you know, by and for young people. But he wanted to get on the phone with me to make sure that I was not some scamming American.
Of course.
So arrangements were made, and I got on the phone with Roald Dahl and his agent to prove that I actually was a 17-year-old kid who wanted to adapt his book. So that was the first musical that I wrote.
That's incredible. You're tenacious. You're tenacious, it seems.
Tenacious, yeah, for sure.
Tenacious and precocious. So then after high school, was that Columbia University? Is that where undergrad was?
Yeah, Columbia University.
And what did you choose? Why Columbia? And what did you choose to study?
I chose Columbia because I wanted to go to New York, because that's where Broadway was.
Yes.
And I had never been to New York before the plane touched down on my first year of college. I'd never been to New York City. But I knew that that's where I wanted to go.
So you were going into the city totally...
I'd never been east of Ohio.
What did your parents think of this?
Well, my parents, my dad was born in Buffalo. My parents met in college upstate at St. Lawrence University. And my mom lived in New York City for a time as a young woman before okay. getting married. So they, I think, were very supportive, always very supportive. I think maybe a little bit nervous, but also quite used to, you know, me being both sort of, as we said, precocious and naive,
yeah.
And heading off to do things. So they really kind of celebrated it, and God bless them, you know, worked very hard to make it possible. I think we got to New York. My freshman year started, this is a little bit of a tangent, but my freshman year started a week after the Central Park jogger.
Oh my gosh.
Raped and murdered. And if you remember, that was in the sort of northeast corner of the park, which is right near where Columbia is. My dorm was about four blocks away from the park. So that was a little bit unsettling for all concerned, but I have to say, as it's a cliche, but as the cab was coming across the Triborough Bridge from the airport and I saw the buildings, I was like, oh, I'm home.
Oh.
This is where I belong.
Now, what did you study at Columbia?
Well, that's the other half of the story. The other reason I went to Columbia is because at the time, Columbia did not have an undergraduate theater major.
Mm.
And I think it does now, but at the time it didn't have an undergraduate theater major. And I chose Columbia in part for its, you know, great reputation. At the time, it was not as highly ranked as it is now. It was sort of a lesser Ivy League school with a little bit of a little bit of a shaggy reputation, which I loved that. Thought that was really cool. And I also, I'm surprised I was this sort of smart as an 18-year-old, but I was like, I don't want to go to a school with a theater major.
Mm.
Because for me, and I love the theater major for a lot of people, but I like, if I am a theater major, I will spend 4 years in the dark theater and I will never learn anything else. And I will come out able to do theater and nothing else. And something in me felt like I would love to learn everything else at school and learn theater, going to Broadway, going to off Broadway, going to off Broadway, working on shows.
Wow. What did you major in?
So I majored in religion.
That's amazing. I did political science in undergrad. I sort of had the same mentality you did. So you did religion. And what was the other one? I'm sorry.
Well, I did religion and English.
Religion and English. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And then
I was just going to major in religion, but my mom was like a devout atheist and was very suspicious of why are you majoring in religion? And she said, you should really double major in something more practical, thinking of the job market. So I said, okay, mom, how about English? And she was like, that's a great idea. And I'm like, you're literally the only woman in the world who thinks English is a practical major. But I doubled. She was helping me quite a bit with college, pay for college and taking care of me through college. So for her, I double majored in English and I'm glad I did. And, you know, it's funny because I'm this liberal arts major, but actually religion and English are like two ideal subjects to prepare you for making theater.
I was going to say there, I don't think you can find a better combination than that.
Yeah, no, I was really, it's so funny. Like, are these choices kind of, you know, you kind of things happen and then you sort of look back and you're like, wow, that actually was really fortuitous.
Yes. Yes. Do you remember what shows you saw when you were living in New York for the first time that had such an impact on you that made you go, oh my gosh, that's what I want to write shows like that or want to be in shows like that, depending.
Vividly. There were quite a few, but one that bears mentioning because I think I saw it on Broadway 20 times is the original Broadway production of Falsettos.
Ooh, what was it about Falsettos that kept making you go back for more and more?
It was everything. It was the songs. It was the fact that it was about gay men and lesbians and very much sort of openly so. And in many ways, you know, celebratory of that, while also, you know, obviously looking very clearly at some of the pains and especially of the AIDS era. And I was just sort of coming into my own sexuality. So it was an incredibly personal story, even though I had very little in common with these characters. I loved them so much. The staging, Lapine's staging and the inventiveness of it and the joy of it and the energy of it. And the it was at once sort of a very sort of spare staging, but so alive in every moment. I mean, it's really not too hard to see the influence of falsettos on Next to Normal in the way that sort of it's a small group of characters and they're sort of ping-ponging around the stage and it's very fluid and it's, you know, we're a little bit less through composed than falsettos was, but very much that was very much an influence. And, you know, in fact, we worked with James Lapine for a while on Next to Normal, and it was a thrill and also a little bit terrifying because he's brilliant and terrifying.
What's something that you learned from him while you were working on Next to Normal that you still take with you today as a writer?
Well, I learned a tremendous amount, but, you know, James is incredibly, you know, brilliantly creative, but also just a very rigorous thinker. And going through Next to Normal with James, and this was before Michael Greif joined us, but going through Next to Normal with James, he had a rigor at looking at every moment and saying, what's happening in this moment? What is this line doing? What is this word doing? He would point at a lyric and be like, what is this? What's happening with this lyric? And I'd be like, well, it just sort of was like, you know, it's sort of to set up the rhyme. He's like, that's not good enough. It needs to be doing something or it needs to go.
Ah.
And he was terrifying, but I less so now that I know him better. He's a very, very kind, lovely man. But his brilliance was in the moment a little bit terrifying and also really transformative.
So let's go back a little bit if we can, because I don't want to jump too far ahead without talking about the genesis of Next to Normal. When did you join the BMI workshop?
Oh, I think in the late 90s.
And why did you want to join this workshop? And can you tell us a little bit about what that workshop is and what it does?
Sure. Well, the BMI Lehman Engel Musical Theater Workshop is really a long-standing workshop for aspiring professional musical theater writers. It was started by Lehman Engel, who was one of the legendary music directors and conductors of the last century, and has among its alums and teachers just this incredible roster of musical theater folks, whether, you know, Maury Yeston or Aarons and Flaherty, you know, just the list goes on and on. And so Tom Kitt and I had written a couple shows together in college. The varsity show was a Columbia University tradition. It was actually the only place where Rodgers, Hammerstein, and Hart all collaborated together on a show.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, very cool. They're all Columbia alums, and they came together to collaborate on a varsity show. And Tom and I wrote two varsity shows together. And at some point after Tom graduated, he's a few years younger than I am, we were, you know, working on some projects and working on our day jobs and kind of, you know, I remember this dinner vividly where we kind of looked across the table at each other. We're like, you know what, we need to be writing musicals. So we applied to the Lehman Engel program and were rejected the first year we applied, but accepted the second year. And that's where, you know, in that workshop, Next to Normal was born.
Why do you like writing with Tom? What does he bring to your collaboration?
Wow. Well, I think it's a long list. I could
we love a long list.
It's a long list. He's a brilliant, I think he's a brilliant songwriter. He's a storyteller. He is a brilliant, you know, creator of theater. He is perhaps the kindest, most generous, most heartfelt person I know. And that quality, his openness, his willingness to show you who he is and what he's feeling and what he believes in and what he yearns for, that comes through in his music in a way that I just find moving again and again. He and I also discovered very early on in college that there was something about writing songs together that we did better work together than we did with anyone else. And there was some, it's difficult to put into words, but there was some chemical way that we clicked together and wrote songs that was unique and special and fun. And to this day, and I've been really blessed to have an interesting and quite varied career. And I've gotten to do a bunch of different things that are interesting and challenging. But to this day, all these years later, my favorite thing to do is to write songs with Tom. And to put our collective talents and our collective personalities and our collective inspiration together and come out with music and with shows.
That is so wonderful to hear, because it brings us so much joy to hear that. What is one of the things that you've learned in that workshop that, once again, you still take with you today as a writer? Or is it just like too many things to mention? Things to do or things not to do?
Well, it is really too many things to mention. It was an incredible education. People often ask me if I went to grad school, and I said I didn't go to grad school, but I went to the Lehman Engel workshop, and that was my grad school.
Yes.
That's really where I learned, and Tom and I learned how to write musicals. The thing that distinguishes a professional musical and a good or a strong professional musical from the very, very many well-intentioned but ultimately sort of not successful amateur musicals is the way the songs fit into and drive the story. How the songs function in a story, what the different kinds of songs there are, the way they move a story forward, how to sequence songs, how to weave songs in with narrative and with dialogue. Those were all things that were taught very clearly and very rigorously in the workshop and then explored through the exercises. And that was invaluable, because I think that it's musicals are hard, even if you have an education in writing them, and knowing what the rules of the road are doesn't mean you can't break them, doesn't mean you can't invent beyond them. Of course you can, but you start with those rules of the road that are taught by people who know and who are passing down a real tradition.
What are some of the musicals that you would recommend to aspiring writers to either go and read or listen to, because you think they do a very wonderful job at structuring an evening of musical theater?
Well, I would say you can't, working backwards.
Yeah.
I think you can't go wrong with Hamilton to start, because Hamilton is incredibly modern. It's incredibly vibrant, but it's brilliantly structured with a surprisingly traditional structure. And I say that in the best way.
Oh, yeah.
It's solid musical theater structure. Then working backwards, I would also, I would point to, I'm trying to pick one of the Aaron and Flaherty musicals. I'm going to say Once on This Island, which is a little bit older. But it's also, on the face of it, you're like, well, this is incredibly fresh, and it is, but it also is very well and traditionally structured in its storytelling and efficient. I think it's like an hour and a half long. And then I would go further back. I really would. I know that, I first started to understand how musicals were structured and the way songs worked through all of Sondheim's musicals. And I think really ideally knowing all of them is something I'd recommend. To start, I think Into the Woods is super accessible, but also incredibly beautifully structured. I think the other, Sunday in the Park with George, which he also wrote with James Lapine, is perhaps a little bit more unorthodox in its structure, but still the way Sondheim uses songs. And I'm having a hard time picking an earlier Sondheim, but I really think that Sweeney Todd is a masterwork, and a masterwork in structure. And the thing about Sweeney Todd, and I don't want to get too wonky, but if those of your listeners who are musicians, and you listen to the musical structure, and the hints that Sondheim puts in the score as the story goes along that are foreshadowing, that are tipping you off to what's happening, that are connecting you to something that happened before, that you saw before, it's brilliant. And I still, every time I see a production of Sweeney Todd, I discover something new about it. And then lastly, I would say it really, even though they haven't all aged well, go back to Rodgers and Hammerstein.
Sure.
Who are, you know, really, and I actually, there was obviously a brilliant sort of, you know, reimagining of it recently that I think only helped sort of underscore how beautifully structured the original was, which is Oklahoma, which is just, and it's, you know, those old musicals can feel corny, but they're so beautifully structured that if you can appreciate, it's like being in an old building and it's still beautiful. And you're like, wow, this is not necessarily, you know, the way they build buildings nowadays, but you look at the structure and the way they're built, they teach you everything you need to know about how to build the building you want to build.
I love that. Those are some fantastic suggestions. Thank you. Let's talk about, where does the idea for Next to Normal come from? Had you always wanted to bring this story to life, or was it an assignment given to you? How did this all come about?
It was an assignment. The sort of culminating assignment of the second or third year of the workshop, I can't remember which, is a 10-minute musical. And the assignment essentially is you have to write a 10-minute musical that tells a complete story with songs and book in 10 minutes. And Tom and I, quite frankly, I wanted to not do a musical about star-crossed lovers or soldiers going off to war or soldiers coming home from war, or, you know, I didn't want to do that. I wanted to find something else, you know, and I'm not really, you know, luckily this is an audio interview, because, you know, if you were looking at me, you'd be like, you look absolutely nothing like a rebel. And so I don't know what you think you're doing. But there was always some part of me that in any class I'm in that is slouching in the back row, grumbling, being a bit cynical. And part of what makes me a great sort of match to Tom, who is like the least cynical person on the planet. But I wanted to do something that was gonna be ass kicking in some way, you know, and then Tom and I could like hop on our motorcycles and drive off into the sunset. So we were looking around for like, what is the idea? And this is a story I've told before, but it's true. I saw a Dateline NBC a story on shock therapy, on electroconvulsive therapy, which I didn't know at the time was still practiced, which it was, and it still is. I really kind of knew it from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And what I learned watching that broadcast and then doing some subsequent research in a very, very primitive version of the World Wide Web. but doing some research, I was like, oh, it is still practiced. It actually is a very important treatment, but that it is not without controversy. And there are some very vivid individual stories that are told with it. So I called up Tom and I said, we met in a cafe at Barnes & Noble on the Upper West Side. Had coffees, and I had one of those peanut butter cup cookies. I don't know if they still have those, but oh my gosh. And I said to him, what about a story about a woman who has been battling depression her whole life and goes through shock therapy? And Tom literally thought about it for like 2 seconds and was like, okay. Which is like and it's one of the great things about our relationship is one of us would be like, what about this? And the other person would be like, all right, let's try it.
Love it.
So we wrote this 10-minute musical for the BMI workshop, and we were fully prepared to be told you can't write about those sorts of things, you can't do that. We thought we'd be run out on the rails. I was kind of hoping we'd be run out on the rails. And there were some people who were like, you can't write a musical about shock therapy or about depression, you just can't do that. But there were other people who felt the exact opposite. And there were a few people who stopped us after the presentation. It was like, you know, my grandmother had shock therapy. She had suffered from, you know, bipolar. Like a couple people had stories to tell us. And so afterwards, you know, for many months afterwards, Tom and I tried to write a couple other musicals. We had a commission for a children's musical that we didn't do so well on, because we kept saying, what about this idea? What about going back to that? We kept coming back to it. So we realized there was something there.
Mm. Now, walk me through that 10-minute musical, if you can. Is it supposed to be the whole story in 10 minutes, or did it just focus on a scene of what was going
to
be an event?
It's supposed to be the whole story. The assignment is tell a story with the beginning, a middle, and an end.
And what was yours? Was Diana there? How did this work?
They didn't have names yet. They were woman, man, daughter, son, and doctor.
So you knew it was a family, though?
We knew it was a family. And it starts off with the woman alone, and then her son comes in, and then the family comes in, and then you find out the son's imaginary, and then she gets taken to the doctor, and the doctor gives her shock therapy, and she comes home and doesn't remember her family, but at least, you know, this imaginary son is gone, and then at the very end of the musical, the imaginary son comes back. So the shape of it was very much the shape of what ended up on Broadway in 10 minutes. And with, you know, only one song from that 10 minute musical survived to the final score, which is I Dreamed a Dance.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
So, you know, you mentioned One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest a little bit earlier. I know Tom has mentioned Ordinary People in a separate interview that we did for the book. Let me ask you, why did you just not choose to adapt One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest or adapt Ordinary People?
I think one of the honest answers is we didn't have the slightest idea as like 27-year-olds how we would go about getting those rights.
Love that. I'm happy you didn't. I'm happy you didn't.
But also, you know, it's funny. It's a good question. It took us famously many, many years to write the thing and rewrite it, partially because we never really had an outline until maybe 5 years into writing it. We just kept writing songs and putting them in place and figuring out what other songs were needed and writing those songs. And this is, by the way, not a process that I recommend to anyone who wants to write musicals. We really did not sort of think it through. It was a very long, much longer process than it needed to be. And we have maybe, I think at one time we counted almost 100 songs that were cut from the show along the way. And then eventually we were working with a dramaturg who was like, would you just write an outline? Can we start with that? And we said, oh, okay, yeah, cool. We'll do that.
I love that. So what? Okay, so you kept wanting to come back to tell this story. What was it about this story that kept gravitating both of you back to it?
We loved writing songs for it. And it kept pulling us back because we realized, and we didn't know this when we started out, but we realized as we were writing it, that not only can you write a musical about mental illness and about family dysfunction and about depression, and not only can you, but it's actually a really great form for writing about those things, because music can depict emotions in a way that words can't. Music, sung music, and also instrumental music can resonate at emotional levels that are much harder to reach with just text. So we realized that the songs were truly getting us deeply inside the emotions of these characters and helping us to relate to them and root for them. And we discovered that more and more as we went on. And I think that's what kept drawing us back to it.
When you were in class and people were saying to you, no, you can't do this, were they saying you can't do this because it's quote unquote not commercial? It's a taboo subject. What exactly was the hesitance? And did you ever once think to yourself, they might be right?
Yeah, I still think they might be right. But even evidence to the contrary, you know, I think the main objection was not so much that it wasn't commercial, but that it wasn't appropriate, that it was somewhat something, that it was taboo, that it was disrespectful. And I've run into this on other projects in other realms in my life where I find myself writing quite a bit about mental health and about trauma and about recovery. And it is a reflex response in many people to say, you can't fictionalize these things. You can't write about these things because it's disrespectful, because these things should be private, because these things are dangerous to write about. And this was our whole, going back to Next to Normal, this was our whole point. We realized over time in writing it that this is how these diseases and these challenges gain their dark power, is because people won't speak of them. And people believe they should be kept hidden and they're shameful and they're not appropriate to be talked about or written about or, God forbid, sung about. And I think that was where the response was coming from. But I should say that I would say probably the more voices, even in the BMI workshop, were encouraging. I would mention Skip Cannon and Maury Yeston were two of our teachers who were super encouraging. And a man who passed away a number of years ago, Richard Enquist, who's a lyricist and a brilliant and beautiful man, was encouraging from the first song we brought in, which is one of the first songs we brought in is no longer in the show, but it was Where Light in the Dark Is Now. And in this version, she was alone in a waiting room waiting to be put on a stretcher to be taken for her first treatment. And she sings a song about it. And that was a very controversial song in the workshop, because you're like, this is not subject matter for musical. And Richard was the moderator. And he said, he had some really sort of helpful criticisms. And then the last thing that happens when you are done presenting is the moderator hands you back your lyric sheet, which they may have marked up along the way. And he handed it back to me and he looked me in the eye and he said, keep going. Oh. And I've always remembered that moment, because that meant everything. Like, Richard looked at me and said, keep going. And we kept going.
And what a great individual he was, my God.
Yeah, he was special.
At what point did this start to look for you that it was going to get a full production somewhere? Was it first at Nymph? Was it at Second Stage? What exactly is the order there?
David Stone, the producer, Wicked and Vagina Monologues and 25th Annual Putnam County Spelling Bee and a bunch of other amazing shows, came to see it at Nymph. His brother is a talent agent and had a client in the show, and David came to see it and called Tom and I into his office and said, I'd like to take this on and produce it. And we were like, oh, okay, thank you, Mr. Stone. Which is actually still how we sound when we talk to Mr. Stone. But that was the moment when we, and Tom and I remember walked out of that meeting going, oh my gosh, like David Stone believes in the show. And look, he believes it has a lot of work that needs to be done, right? He's not opening it tomorrow, but he believes in it. And that was, that changed everything.
Was there ever a note that was given to you throughout the process that made you go, no, this is, I think that's the opposite note of what I want to do with this story? And how do you handle situations like that?
You know, we spent many years casting around, like in the early writing of it before David Stone saw it, with a lot of people giving very well-intentioned advice that sort of led us down a wrong path.
What path was it heading on before David got involved, do you think?
Well, you know, when David got involved in the Nymph version of it, which I think can probably still be found on the internet if anyone's interested, was much longer, and it was it had a sort of tongue in cheek attitude towards, especially towards ECT and towards, to some extent, towards the towards psychiatry in general, and towards Diana's experience. And David, you know, I'm actually answering the opposite of your question, but David said to us early on, he said, there's two musicals here. One of them is very snarky and sarcastic and a little bit jejune. And the other is a really significant and deep story of a woman and a family in pain. And he said, it's not that you can't pull off both of those things, but it's hard. And it may be that you have to choose one of them. And really, subsequent to his saying that, we worked with James Lapine. And then after James Lapine, we worked with Michael Greif, who was just so brilliant at asking us the kinds of questions that made us think about what we wanted the show to be and how to best tell the story we wanted to tell. Over the course of those years, working with Michael and working with David, and we really sort of honed in on what the musical was, what the heart of it was, and what it wasn't.
And what is the heart of it?
I think the heart of Next to Normal is the idea that pain is a reality of life, and the struggles of loss and of grief and of the complications of grief when it intertwines with mental illness, and the impact that has not only on the person struggling, but on the people who love that person. Those are real and they're painful, but that they can be survived. And that in some ways, survival is the happy ending. Right? We very specifically, you know, did not put a simple happy ending on Next to Normal, but we believed that survival and fighting the fight and getting out of bed one more day to fight, keep fighting that good fight, that is the happy ending. That's the light.
And tell me a little bit about the audience reaction to when it was done at Second Stage, which please correct me if I'm wrong, this was the first time a general public paying audience was seeing it fully formed. Is that correct?
It was, yeah, for sure. Except for a few hundred people at NIMH, that was the first, you know, Second Stage was off Broadway was the first, the unveiling in public. And, you know, the audience response was remarkable. It was varied, you know, it was intensely revealing. Because there were moments in the musical where you could feel that whole room of people leaning in and incredibly involved. And then there were moments where you could feel them all lean back and go, what is going on?
Is there an example of either one of those from that Second Stage
production? For sure. There's the Second Stage production, the first act ended with a song called Feeling Electric, which was the original title of the musical was Feeling Electric. And the song called Feeling Electric, which was also in the 10-minute musical, but did not ultimately survive to Broadway. Basically, the doctor, Dr. Madden, came out as a rock star and sang a song called Feeling Electric while Diana got her electroconvulsive therapy. And it was meant to be satirical, I think, but it did not come across. And it was a great song, as songs go. I love the song. It did not come across in the moment. So after a really intense first act, much of which had the audience really involved, you could feel them all sort of lean back at the end and be like, wait, what is going on? But in Second Stage, as on Broadway, there is a moment near the end of the second act where Gabe, the son, finally approaches and speaks to and then embraces his father, who was played off Broadway by Brian D'Arcy James. That moment when Aaron Tveit embraced Brian D'Arcy James was every night the audience was just riveted and many of them in tears and just completely in sync with the actors on stage. And that was an incredible moment. So to have the sort of incredibly like resonant, powerful moments that were working and these moments that were clearly not working was really interesting.
Now, after Second Stage, did it go directly to Broadway or did you go someplace else?
No, our reviews at Second Stage were decidedly mixed. and I sort of at that time, I was like, well, that's it. I'll never have a career. And I actually like registered for the GRE. I was going to go back to school and study something else. But David Stone said, no, we're gonna keep working on this. So he did something that at the time I think was kind of unprecedented. He said, we're not going to go to Broadway, but we're going to go to the Arena Stage in Washington, D.C. and work on it again there. And that's what we did. Michael Greif led the whole company. The next winter, I think we all went to the Arena Stage in Washington, D.C., which at the time was run by Molly Smith and David Dower, who were two like brilliant human beings who were also like we just had on the journey of the show, we had these guardians, or I'm not sure what the word for them is. We had these sages, these kind people along the way who got what we were trying to do and asked us questions and had ideas and had thoughts that made us go, oh, thank you for that. Like we just got these gifts along the way. You know, Peter Askin, who was the first director who also directed the off-Broadway production of Hedwig and the Angry Inch, was another one of those. We just had these people along the way, and it really did take all of these, you know, incredible sort of sages to guide us to what the show ultimately became. So we reworked it, we rewrote, you know, the show kind of top to bottom. I think we replaced a dozen songs and opened at Arena Stage and got a really beautiful review from Peter Marks, who is, you know, for that reason and others, a hero of mine to this day. Even though he didn't like If Then all that much, that's okay. I still love him.
Good.
And that propelled us back to Broadway.
And, you know, let's talk a little bit about the interaction that you had on Broadway with the audiences, because I believe you were the first show to use Twitter as a means of marketing. Is that correct?
We did a pilot with this company Situation Interactive, which is still around and awesome, and worked with Twitter, and together they had this idea, what if we tweeted the show? They came to me and said, what about a Twitter performance of the show? I'm like, how would that work? And at that point, Twitter was 140 characters. It's more now, but at the time it was 140 characters. And I was like, how would that work? And they said, well, what if we just do the whole show with all the characters tweeting as themselves? So for instance, at one point, Natalie sends a tweet. Does anybody else's mother make peanut butter sandwiches on the floor, or is that just our family? You know, and so we basically through that and using some lyrics and using, you know, we tweeted the whole show over a period of days. It was kind of an amazing thing. And some people didn't realize it was a fiction and a theater thing, and like responded to these characters. And it was really kind of just incredibly heartbreaking and heartening, because like men, like Dan would write about sort of his struggles of trying to take care of his family and trying to take care of his wife. And men would tweet back at him and say, hang in there, you're doing great. And it was clear that some of them didn't know he was a fictional character. And part of me was like, I feel bad about this. But part of me was like, this is beautiful. Yeah, it's really amazing how people are responding.
I think it's beautiful. Did you have any face-to-face interaction with audience members after one of these performances?
Yeah, I mean, always. And it was one of the things, to an earlier question of yours, one of the things that kept us going for all of those years was every time we would do a reading or a workshop, or we did some workshop productions at Village Theater out in the Seattle area. And every time we did a workshop, people would line up afterwards to talk to us, to tell us their stories, to tell us their stories of their own struggles with mental illness, of a family member who had gone through ECT, of a family member and their sort of struggles to find the right medication, every performance. And that was more than anything else, as we moved along in the process, Tom and I would look at each other and be like, you know, there's something here. And it happened all the time. And there's one particular moment I remember that Tom and I will never forget. We were in previews on Broadway, and we felt the show was working, but we had no, it was New York, it's Broadway. We had no idea how it was going to be received. So we didn't know, but we were working and we were, doing good work, but it's Broadway, there's uncertainty. And one night, Tom and I are standing in the back of the house as the audience is leaving. And this kid, 15, 16 years old, I remember him so vividly, this really sort of sweet looking redheaded kid came up and said, "Are you Mr. Yorkie?" And I said, "Well, no, actually that's my dad, but I'm Brian and this is Tom." And we shook hands and he said, "Thank you for writing this." And he started to cry. I still start to cry when I tell the story. And he said, "Thank you for writing this. I was just diagnosed with bipolar and I had no way to explain to my friends what that was or what it felt like. And now I can point to the show and say, this is what it's like. So thank you for writing it." And he's in tears and Tom and I are in tears and we thanked him and he went on his way. And I looked at Tom, I said, "At this point, I don't care what the critics say. Like, if we can do that for that kid, we've done it."
You gave a voice to the voiceless, and you moved the needle on the discussion, an open discussion about mental health in this country. Why do you think up until your show, mental health was not something that was supposed to be, quote unquote, discussed in public?
Well, I think it's still a struggle. Mm-hmm. I think you still see, especially lately, athletes who are being incredibly courageous and coming forward and talking about their own struggles with mental health. They're not universally celebrated for doing so. It's still, there is this stigma attached to mental illness, which is so hard to understand exactly why, because there's no stigma attached to, breaking your leg. There's mm-hmm. no stigma attached to, Lyme disease. Do you know what I mean? Like those things are physical things that happen to you. But they also affect your mental health. But there is something about, I could go off and I have my own pet theories. I think that we are still paying this price for the Puritans who founded our country and believed that the best motivator was shame. And that, mental illness doesn't really exist. You just need to pull yourself up by your bootstraps and get yourself better. And it sounds, coming out of my mouth, it sounds like, how can anyone still believe this? But people still do.
Well,
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, recently I was thinking of Simone Biles in the Olympics as an example of that.
Simone Biles and Naomi Osaka. I mean, like so many like amazing athletes who the struggles are real. And especially for people in the public eye, they're intensified by the criticism and especially by the just sort of unthinking, unfeeling criticism. And here's the fact for everyone who is critical of anyone who struggles with or seeks help for their mental health. There are very few of us, whether we admit it or not, very few of us are free of mental health challenges. And even if you are blessed to be in excellent mental health all the time, even through 2+ years of a pandemic, and God love you if you are blessed, there is someone you love who is struggling. And the fact that it's hard to talk about makes the struggle exponentially harder. So our show, athletes, movie stars, rock stars who come out and say, "I struggle with," politicians who come out and say, "I struggle with depression, I struggle with bipolar, I struggle with anxiety." I think they're all my heroes, because the more we talk about it, the more that stigma loses its power.
Mm. Well, Brian, thank you for that. And I thank both you and Tom for giving the world such a amazing show. One, a grippingly dramatic show, but two, that opened up a conversation that really needed to be had. So thank you for that. And listeners, thank you so much for joining us today. Please make sure to purchase a copy of 50 Key Stage Musicals by visiting Routledge.com or by clicking in today's show description. If you want to learn more about Next to Normal, please also review the links in the below description. I'm Robert W. Schneider, and thank you for listening to 50 Key Stage Musicals, the podcast. Bye-bye.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.